This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Do you hear the sound? The melody of squeaking sneakers and thumping basketballs. Like a crocus popping through the mud or baseball players flocking south, March Madness is a rite of spring. Dozens of men's and women's college teams are getting set to compete for Division I championships in the NCAA tournaments, but just as the grand entertainment is about to begin, a series of scandals has erupted in the men's game. St. Bonaventure forced its president to resign, Villanova suspended a dozen players, Georgia and Fresno State withdrew their teams from postseason competition. Later in the program, we'll talk about the prospects of Britain's proposal to amend the UN Security Council resolution on Iraq, and we'll speak with Senator Carl Levin, who charges that the CIA has not told weapons inspectors much of what it knows about Iraq's chemical and biological weapons. But first, the relationship between academia and big-time sports, how it developed and how it works now. Our guests include a prominent critic, a major university president, and a Division I coach, and we want to hear from you. Is there a fundamental conflict between institutions of higher learning and billion-dollar sports deals? Should present arrangements be reformed, blown up, or are we just talking about a few relatively isolated incidents? If you're a fan, a booster, or a critic, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman, who's with us from his office in Portland, Oregon. And Tom, always good to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil. Great to be here.
A lot of events this week and last. Can you walk us through them?
Yes. As you mentioned, a startling confluence of scandals. As you said, it is a significant time in college basketball. People call it March Madness, as you say. A friend of mine calls it the High Holy Season. As you said, in a span of about 2 weeks, these four scandals have come to light. At Fresno State, there were allegations of academic fraud, that a former team statistician wrote papers for three players. And at this point, it's still allegations, but the team did remove itself from postseason play. At Villanova, the school suspended 12 players for allegedly making unauthorized phone calls. At the University of Georgia, the university found evidence of academic fraud, players allegedly attending a phony class taught by the men's basketball assistant coach Jim Herrick Jr. He was fired, and his dad, head coach Jim Herrick, was suspended with pay while the investigation continued. And as you said, Georgia withdrew itself from postseason tournaments. And then the weirdest situation at St. Bonaventure, the team had to forfeit games and it was banned from its conference tournament because of an ineligible player. Then the team decided it wasn't going to play the final two regular season games because of the problems. And then the university president resigned because of his role in bringing that ineligible player to campus. And now St. Bonaventure is basically trying to save itself from getting kicked out of its conference, the Atlantic 10.
Now, where do these universities fit into the structure of big-time basketball? How, you know, Georgia is very competitive this year.
Very competitive. Well, Villanova and St. Bonaventure, they both have long traditions in men's college basketball. They weren't making a big impact this year. Fresno State won the Western Athletic Conference and had a good chance to get into the NCAA tournament. And Georgia, as you mentioned, probably the biggest blow to that program, they were ranked in the top 25 in the nation, 21 in one poll and 22 in another. They were playing very well, and college basketball insiders believe Georgia even had a chance to make it to the Final Four and beyond, maybe even win the tournament.
What is the NCAA saying about this? I mean, these are not certainly the first allegations of academic fraud.
No, it's interesting because it definitely seems like a black mark on college sports and the NCAA, but the NCAA seems to be taking the offensive and talking about how the system works, because in all four cases, as we've talked about, the universities punished themselves. Villanova suspended its own players, Fresno State took itself out of postseason competition, as did Georgia, and the St. Bonaventure Board of Trustees forced the president of the university to resign. resign. But critics say, you know, don't feel too good about this. These self-sanctions may be proactive, but what about the underlying causes of all the scandals in the first place? And there are many, including your guest, Professor Sperber, who believe there are major systemic problems that keep making these scandals pop up. And a big one is a fundamental contradiction of big-time college athletics. On the one hand, the NCAA is trying to enforce rules based on the ideal of amateurism, and they're doing it with this enormous and often confusing rule book.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the top levels, of particularly of men's college basketball and football, they're getting more and more commercialized and generating huge entertainment dollars. The $6 billion TV contract that CBS paid to the NCAA to broadcast the college basketball tournament.
That is over 11 years, so it's not just 1 year, but it's still
right.
Quite a bit of money, more than half a billion per year. What about the women? They're more and more of their games are being broadcast as well. Are they being touched by this?
Yeah, you know, sadly, we're watching women's college basketball and talking about the end of the UConn streak. But what should be pointed out is the women have really kind of avoided all of this slop. And granted, there's not as much money involved in women's hoops or women's sports in general. So, you know, at the end of the rainbow, there's not that potential payday. But you do find that largely women are involved in collegiate sports more along the lines of that ideal, the amateur student athlete, and one can only hope that as women's sports grow and as the women's college basketball tournament becomes more and more popular, that the players don't succumb to the temptations and get involved in scandals, and that winning at all costs doesn't drive the coaches and school officials to recruit questionable athletes.
NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Tom Goldman speaking with us from his office in Portland, Oregon. Well, joining us now from member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, is Murray Sperber. He's the author of Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education, and an American Studies professor at Indiana University. And Professor Sperber, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
Can you first walk us through some of the history of amateur athletics and big money? I mean, how did we get here where college football and basketball have become such hugely popular and high-stakes competition?
Well, I think Tom was right to start with this amateur ideal, which is really a British aristocratic idea that was transported to America in the 19th century. And so when schools started playing sports, they wanted the athletes to be Simon Pure and to be amateurs. Then into the 20th century, college football became immensely popular. The first stadiums in America were Harvard Stadium and Yale Bowl. And the Ivy Leagues, as well as the service academies, were tremendously popular, but the players were still essentially students. The same in basketball, which was increasingly popular in the 20s and 30s. And so what you had is essentially these sports without minor leagues, because the NFL only becomes popular in the 1950s with the advent of TV, mm-hmm. and the NBA not till the 1970s, really. And so when pro sports starts and talented youngsters with phenomenal athletic ability want to play football for a living or basketball for a living, they have to go through the colleges. Now, in baseball and hockey, you have sports where there had long been minor leagues, and as a result, many people went directly into the minor league system. So you've got this kind of hybrid, and it's only in America where we have this system, where if you're a talented youngster in basketball and football, you know you have to go to college. And unfortunately, in this day and age, you're not a dumb jock so much as somebody who is working his or her way through college. An athletic scholarship is a one-year renewable contract, essentially, with the school. It's renewed every July at the behest, basically, of the coach. And many athletes are cut not for academic reasons, but for athletic reasons. The coach doesn't think they're working out. So athletes are in 30, 40, 50 hours a week training. The NCAA has this rule. It's only supposed to be 20 hours a week, but that's mandatory. The rest is voluntary. And somehow the whole team manages to volunteer for endless hours of weight training, tape viewing, as well as in the Rashidi Wheeler case at Northwestern, where the player died on the practice field in the summer. The whole team was there, but it was voluntary. So it's very hard for athletes in this highly intensive program, programs, which are driven by coaches who are chasing million-dollar contracts, to also go to school. I mean, I've taught many athletes over the years. I've interviewed many more. And I've encountered very few dumb jocks. But what I have met over and over again are physically and mentally exhausted young men and women who, as a result, academically underachieve. I mean, the real proof to me is I've had athletes when their eligibility is over, either through 4 years of playing or injury, and they're often wonderful students. Mm-hmm. I mean, the discipline they've learned in sports, they can apply full-time to going to school. And they're much better than my beer-drinking frat rat party students who never get with the academic program. And so it's really this problem of balancing this full-time job in commercial entertainment that athletes with eligibility have versus being a student in a meaningful curriculum. One of the ways it's solved is schools set up these kind of Mickey Mouse curriculums, not as outrageous as that course at Georgia where they got an automatic A
right.
for not even attending, but there's some very soft curriculum out there, which unfortunately athletes are channeled to because the NCAA wants to maintain this student-athlete fiction.
We all remember the great quote of Joe Namath when he was drafted by the Jets, and somebody asked him at a news conference, gee, Joe, what did you take down there at Alabama, basket weaving? And he said, nah, journalism, it's easier, which suggested he was no dumb jock either.
Right.
Let's go to the phones, 800-989-8255. Our first caller is John, who's on the line with us from Toledo, Ohio.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question is, or comment, there are definitely coaches, college coaches in this country who have tremendous graduation rates and are producing great scholar athletes from their basketball programs, like Mike Krzyzewski at Duke. You know, I get that impression that certainly what controversial at Indiana, Bob Knight, but he was graduating his players. And I'm wondering what you or the panel might have to say. You know, why isn't that happening everywhere, and why aren't those standards being set by the NCAA so that coaches have to meet those standards?
I think, can I answer that, Neil?
Yeah, please go ahead.
There's two answers. A, it's a myth that Bob Knight graduated all his players. It was in the 40 percentile. That's the NCAA statistics. But as far as Krzyzewski at Duke, it's really called demography. In any given year of high school seniors, there's a small number who can get over 1,200 on their SATs and also are blue chippers with NBA potential. And Krzyzewski has positioned Duke to get that small number. Stanford on the West Coast gets that small number. But if you want to really see how it works, tell me about Duke football. Football coach at Duke can't get any of them. Whereas at Notre Dame, they get a pretty good number. And so, but when you go beyond this very small demographic pool, you have many athletes without very good SATs because, frankly, they've been working on their athletic skills since they were, you know, small children in many cases. And when you go further beyond and you're in situations where it's hard to recruit, but you want to win, so you get the blue chip athletes, but you often get very socially and academically marginal people. So I think much of the problems result from this very basic demography.
John, it sounds like you're speaking with some degree of experience here.
I'm a high school girls coach, so no college experience, that's for sure. But it sounds like you're saying that it's a personality issue, that when a coach has set these high standards maybe for himself or herself, that those are the kind of players that they get and they're able to win with those kinds of players? Are you saying it's tradition?
Well, I'm also saying
I'm going to ask you both to hold on with us. John, if you can stay with us a minute, we're going to take a short break and come back.
I sure can.
All right, I'm going to put you on hold, and Murray Sperber, we've already arranged for you to stay with us, so Murray Sperber of Indiana University will be with us after we return from a short break. We're talking about amateur athletics and the big money sporting events, and taking your calls at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send email to us, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about big-time college sports as the big-time college basketball championships get set to begin. Is the high-stakes money affecting student-athletes and academic integrity, or does the system work and it's just a few bad participants that taint it? You're invited to join our discussion. 800-989-TALK. Email address is TOTN@NPR.org. With us from Indiana is Murray Sperber, professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University and a critic of the current NCAA system. And with us on the line from Toledo, Ohio is John. And just before the break, he's a high school girls coach. And I wanted to ask you, John, you know, how do you balance in high school the demands of academics and athletics? I assume that in part you're paid to win ball games.
In part, sure. We have eligibility standards that our state sets, and that we have to monitor our students. And if they're ineligible, then it's a no-brainer. They're not allowed to play. There are other standards, behavior standards that high schools set, of course, that determine whether or not their players are going to be eligible and are able to participate. And let me say that I would say in general, I have coached boys in the past, that it's quite a bit easier to deal with our young ladies, actually.
What did you think of earlier this year when the scandal erupted in high school, not in your state, I don't think, or was it in Ohio, about the young man and whose mother was able to buy a very expensive car on the prospect that he'll be joining the National Basketball Association next year?
It's a futures market, it seems to be. Well, I would say that somebody gave her that loan with pretty good information that he's going to be worth quite a lot of money very shortly. In fact, my son was scrambling to try to get tickets because he's going to be playing in Toledo, in fact, on Thursday night in the state tournament. So there is certainly, you know, a fervor over his ability and his future. Are you asking about that loan specifically?
Well, no, I was just asking, you were talking about the high school system, and seemingly the high school system certainly allowed his mother to get a loan on his future. At the least, it stinks.
Neil?
Yeah.
Could I answer John's question on the college level?
Okay, quickly, because we have another guest we want to get to.
Yeah. He said, how can colleges, accept student athletes, in a sense, promote the student part of the student athlete equation? And I think you'll have the coach from Navy and then the president of Vanderbilt. These schools, in some ways, have accepted losing. Navy was ranked something like 144th on the USA Today final football polls. Vanderbilt was something like 97th and the bottom of their conference. What they're saying essentially is we want our athletes to be real students. But they also recognize that they cannot compete with the people at the top of their conferences or the people at the top of college sports, where the athletes are much more marginal students. So I applaud Vanderbilt and Navy, but in a sense, it's time to restructure all of college sports.
Well, John, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate
it. Thank
you. And good luck to you.
Thank you.
Joining us now by phone is the Chancellor of Vanderbilt University, Gordon Gee. He's with us from his office in Nashville, Tennessee. His team, the Commodores, now that University of Georgia has pulled out of the Southeastern Conference Tournament, is now seated fifth now that the conference tournament is about to begin. And Chancellor Gee, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Neil. Wonderful to be with you.
Well, we just heard Murray Sperber say that, in a sense, people like Vanderbilt, your school, accepts the idea of real student athletes, but has also accepted that you can't compete in the Southeastern Conference.
Well, first of all, I'm a great admirer of Professor Sperber. I was president of Ohio State and part of that Big Ten Conference, where he was very much a vocal advocate for good quality athletic academic programs. So I appreciate that. Let me just say a couple of quick things. One is the fact that I get asked that question a lot. Do you accept that you're just going to have to field a poor team? We won several awards last year in college football. We won the award for having the highest graduation rate in America, 100%, and I'm very proud of that. But I don't accept the fact that we can't compete. What I do believe is that we should not lower our standards, that we should ask everyone else to raise their standards.
Mm-hmm. I
think that is really the issue, because what we're constantly saying is, if you're going to compete, you have to lower your standards. And my view is that the SEC, where I'm going to be at the president's meeting tomorrow, that we need to work very hard to raise the academic standards for all of college athletics as part of the academic enterprise.
Well, the SEC is probably the most successful athletic conference in the big-time sports, basketball and football. You've been quoted as saying the SEC is viewed as a place where athletics drive academics, that 12 schools banded together in order to play football and basketball, not in order to educate students.
Well, I think that we need to change that, and certainly that's going to be part of the conversation we have tomorrow. Indeed, my view is the fact that we should not simply be institutions that come together for a Saturday afternoon, but the real power of a conference is when we provide a whole host of opportunity to engage in academic enterprise across the 12 schools. And we did that in the Big Ten. As you know, there are 11 institutions in the Big Ten, and we did that on a frequent basis, and I think it made those institutions much better.
Let's get a listener involved. Steve is on the line with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi. Appreciate your conversation. Appreciate you taking the call. I think, as President Xi was alluding to, too many schools allow themselves to be defined in terms of their athletic programs. The New York Times Magazine had an article recently about that sort of thing. It had a profile of the University of South Florida, which is a relatively young institution, and how literally it's considered itself somewhat of an anonymous institution. It's only 40 years old, so it's literally banked its future on building a big-time football program, and it competes reasonably well at the mid-major level, and currently pays its coach $500,000 a year. Well, that's ridiculous. If they want to build their reputation, that $500,000 they pay to coach Jim Leavitt, they could hire several faculty members, beef up their academics, and become known as an academic institution rather than a jock factory.
Well, let me comment. First of all, I think that we have an arms race going on in college athletics, and we just need to diminish that. And by that, I mean that we're raising salaries and building huge stadiums and a variety of other things. Now, I do have a proposal which I think will move to equalize the nature of intercollegiate athletes, and not a lot of people are happy about it. In some form or other, these proposals are going forward, at least in some way, in the NCAA right now. And they're very simple, Neil, and I'll just quickly say them. One is the fact that in order to finally deal with the academic issues that we have to in intercollegiate athletes, one is the fact that we have to tie scholarships to graduation rates. If they don't graduate students and they don't get scholarships, that then cuts off the lifeblood of an institution. When you have some institutions that have a 5 or an 8 or a 10% graduation rate, which I think is abominable, that we have to deal with that. Secondly of all, we make certain that every student athlete takes a core curriculum. This notion of being able to take welding, or a notion of taking advanced basketball or whatever, that is not within the academic interest of an institution. Every student athlete should be required to make sure that they can read and write and take the basic fundamental courses that every student within the institution should be taking. We need to monitor that. And then finally, and perhaps the killer proposal, which I hope will get passed, is the fact that we tie distribution of, we talk about the $6 billion contract with CBS. Well, I tell you what, let's do. Let's tie the distribution of those dollars to graduation rates. That will fundamentally change the nature of intercollegiate athletics for the better if we finally do some things like that, which are powerful and maybe even draconian, but will deal with the issue as it should be dealt with.
I know that many people will have heard Murray Sperber on Morning Edition today advocate the idea of accepting the fact that your student athletes are really professionals, and they are university employees, and they ought to be paid.
Well, you know, I listened to Murray say that this morning. I was on my running machine, and I ran right off it almost, because the minute that we turn intercollegiate athletics, the nature of into professional programs, then that is the day that we ought to close them down. I simply do not accept that as a proposition.
Well, can I reply?
You can, but I think we've got to let Chancellor Gee get on to other business. We appreciate your time, Chancellor.
Great. Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
Appreciate it. Gordon Gee is Chancellor of Vanderbilt University, and he was with us from his office in Nashville. But, Murray, why don't you go ahead?
Well, I think your caller raises, a key point. Many presidents have told me, many trustees of schools across the country, that the publicity, you've got to have a big-time team because the publicity is wonderful. You get all this free publicity on the sports pages and TV and such. And indeed, when you're winning and you're running a clean program, it cuts through a lot of media noise and it's very positive. But I always say the publicity from college sports is a two-edged sword. And that sword can swing back at you at any time. And if you have a scandal, the media doesn't go away. In fact, more seem to come. So take St. Bonaventure. I had always known that as a small, very good liberal arts school in upstate New York and such. And now, unfortunately, I know a friend of mine who's a graduate of it called me up and said, people are starting to say to me, did I get a real degree or did I get a certificate in welding, as that player who was ineligible had from a junior college? And so that sword cut St. Bonaventure very deeply, and it's going to be a long time before they change their reputation. The University of Georgia is a school that's improving, has the Hope Scholarships, and very much improving academically, but this scandal is going to hurt them, and this is a national event. So I think when people like the University of South Florida, which your caller mentioned, mm-hmm. want to throw millions, and by the way, college sports loses lots of money, want to throw millions at building a football team, they should think very deeply, because obviously in the state of Florida, your prime athletes, as well as your those athletes with high SAT scores, are going to go to Miami, are going to go to University of Florida Gainesville or Florida State. University of South Florida is very far down the food chain, and they're going to have to recruit, if they want to play at the highest level, some very socially and academically marginal athletes. So there's going to be scandals. So it just seems to me such a no-brainer. Your caller understood it very deeply, that I've never understood why schools are willing to throw this fortune at big-time college sports.
Murray Sperber, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Murray Sperber, a professor of English and American Studies at Indiana University. His most recent book is Beer and Circus, How Big-Time College Sports is Crippling Undergraduate Education. And he was with us from member station WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. And joining us now by phone from his office in Annapolis is head coach of the Division I U.S. Naval Academy, Don DeVoe. He's led three different teams to the NCAA tournament, though their loss Saturday in the Patriot League has taken Navy out of tournament action this year. It has given us the opportunity for a few minutes of Coach DeVoe's time, and thanks very much for joining us on Talk of the Nation.
Well, you're most welcome.
How responsible are coaches in looking out for NCAA violations?
I would say that most coaches are really concerned about having great ethics in coaching. But I think, again, there are some, you know, who just really truly feel the pressure of having to do things that are in the gray area, you know, to try to attract student athletes to their campuses. And that's where you really get into trouble. You get into these gray areas, and there, you might say, well, there aren't gray areas. The rules are very explicit, and I think the rules are quite explicit in some cases. But again, coaches feel a tremendous amount of pressure because coaches are hard for one reason, and that is to put, you know, winning basketball teams on the court. And the only way coaches can win is to get players, you know, with great athleticism, and therein lies a problem. You know, you find coaches that will really feel the pressure, and if they're not experienced and they're not of maybe the highest moral character, why, they will succumb to trying to do a few things for, you know, some student athletes that should not, in my opinion, ever be in an institution of higher education to begin with.
Coach Don DeVoe of Navy, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, Coach, you talk about the NCAA rules. Are these, you know, they are incredibly complicated. Are they ridiculous in your, I mean, you know, they ban a player from accepting a T-shirt?
Well, you know, you get into this thing of extra benefits. You know, an extra T-shirt is a T-shirt. You know, it has some monetary value. You have this young man in Ohio who accepted some garb from a local dealer that was worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars. Yes, you know, you want NCAA athletics to be of the amateur basis, and if you're going to have amateurism, they can't accept anything of monetary value. I mean, you know, yes, a T-shirt, you know, is a T-shirt, and maybe it doesn't cost much, but it does have monetary value, and it does have great monetary value in some circles.
On the other end of the spectrum, you've gotten players that we've heard about this year who've been involved in gambling, a guy who has apparently been involved in betting in every football game he ever played in Florida.
And, yes, that happens. I mean, you cannot have tens of thousands of young people in this country participating in amateur athletics without a few, you know, going to the left side. Whenever you have rules and regulations, you're always going to have a few, and it's those very few that get the bad publicity. And the publicity, of course, is bad. It's publicity that is not warranted, perhaps. But, again, these young people sometimes feel that, you know, they are the exception, and they veer a little bit to the left, and sure enough, you know, it gives intercollegiate athletics and these institutions that are really fine schools and really mean to do well type institutions, you know, a black eye.
Let's get a caller involved. Steve joins us on the line from Hamilton, Massachusetts.
Hi, gentlemen. How you doing?
Okay.
You know, we're talking semantics here. You're talking about amateur sports, but the fact of the matter is it not, Coach, that at this level it's really a business? And it's the basketball team or the football team, maybe not at the Naval Academy, but at most Division I schools, is used to fund the rest of the athletic department and or in many cases bring in funding from alumni who give because in part they have a successful team from their alma mater?
Well, I think you're right to a degree. I mean, you can look at us as being in a business, because if we're not successful, why, you know, we won't be here very long. But again, you know, you have to remember, you know, we are supposed to be hallowed institutions where, you know, amateurism reigns supreme. But it is difficult sometimes to believe that when you see the pressures that are put on coaches and pressures put on the players, you know, to be successful.
Well, isn't it just a microcosm of the business world? I have a son who goes to the University of Virginia, and Coach Pete Gillen down there cost himself several games by suspending a player that he didn't have to suspend and sitting his best player down for a couple of halves because he was late to a practice, I understand. And here's a guy who I'm sure is taking a lot of heat, but ethically, I believe he did the right thing. And as a parent of a student at that university, I actually emailed the president and said, I believe in this guy. I think he did the right thing. I believe that he showed my son and his players and all the people at the university that it's more important to do the right thing and teach people a lesson that way than to win a basketball game or two.
And see, that thought should be promoted around the country because, again, I think Pete Gillen is one of those individuals that is highly regarded everywhere, and you know he has his rules and regulations, and you know if players don't abide by those rules, why, you know, they should be penalized. But again, a lot of coaches really feel the heat. You know, I mean,
and do you when
you're expected to win, and
but when you're hired by
you're put in a tough position.
Yeah, but when you're hired by a program, do you have to say you know if you're going to run a clean program, you can't expect to win the championship of the NCAA.
Well, you know, coaches are expected to win, you know, and that is something that we all understand. But I don't think there's ever a coach who has written in his contract that he has to win a certain percentage of his games. You know, and if you're hiring people of high ethical character, I think that they will run a very good program. But again, there's always going to be the few. There will always be a few that will be, you know, pointed out as people who perhaps had a weakness, you know, and if they have a little bit of a weakness in their character or they have too many players that have weaknesses in their characters, these young people will bring
Coach,
bad
I'm afraid,
and that's what we're seeing right now.
Gotta go, Coach. Bye.